I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Famed tightrope walker Nick Wallander is planning to walk along the Orlando Eye while it spins. His 400-foot-high stroll will set a Guinness World Record as spectators look on from below. PNC Vice President Greg Simmons took time out from the boardroom to climb 19,000 feet to the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. University of Central Florida creative writing professor Pat Rushen's book, The Call, was made into the feature film The Zero Theorem. The main character in the book is searching for meaning in a meaningless world. What drives people to seek out the extraordinary? A conversation with modern-day adventurers, both literal and literary. That's ahead on Intersection. Nick Wallander is a seventh-generation member of a family of high-wire walkers and stunt artists. The Sarasota native has performed stunts like riding a bicycle on a wire 135 feet above the ground and tightrope walking across the Niagara Falls and the Grand Canyon. Next week, he'll try something a little different, walking on the Orlando Eye. That's the 400-foot-tall Ferris wheel that looms over Eye Drive as it spins. He joins us now from Chicago.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if you could just describe what it is you'll be doing on April 29th.
Well, I've been invited to appear for the grand opening of the beautiful observation wheel there in Orlando, the Orlando Eye. For that event, I'll actually be riding in a capsule just like any regular attendee would, riding up to the top of the eye there. And once we get to the apex, that wheel will stop spinning. I will get out of that capsule by climbing out of the roof. I will climb down a series of ladders and basically walk on the rim, if you will, of the actual wheel as it is turning. I'll start in one capsule, and I'll walk for a distance that will be predetermined. We haven't finalized those details yet. And I'll stop on another capsule and climb back in and get back into that capsule and ride back down to the bottom.
Okay, so how fast is the wheel moving?
You know, it's the way that it's been described to me is a walking pace. It's not running, it's not strolling slow, but it's a walking pace, a nice steady pace.
And will you have the bar that you typically have when you're on a high one?
There'll be no balance bar for this one because of the structure of the apparatus itself. There's no way to use a balancing bar. It would get in the way as I was walking. So for this one, I'll be doing it, as we call it in our industry, freehand. I will not be using any balancing bar whatsoever.
Is that something you've done a lot of before?
You know, not in a public setting, that's for sure. This is a first for me. I, of course, have trained on a wire my entire life. My family's been in this occupation for over 200 years, and I was kind of born on the wire. But I've never done it in a public setting and certainly never done it in a wheel, and no one in the world's ever done it on a wheel this high. This will actually be a Guinness World Record.
So just describe, if you could, what's the advantage of having the bar that you would normally have when you're on high wire?
You know, it's really two different styles of walking. When you use a balancing bar, it basically takes your center of gravity and sends it out to the ends of that balancing pole. If you get hit with a gust of wind or if that wire or whatever you're walking on moves, you have a little bit of time to adjust. Well, without that bar, you better react at a split second because as soon as you feel any movement, you've got to react, use your arms to kind of extend out, but that's all you got to work with.
Mm-hmm. And have you done something like this before in terms of walking on something that's not a wire?
I've walked on a Ferris wheel before, actually, but I used a balance bar, and it was much lower. It was about 40 feet off the ground, whereas this one is 10 times higher at over 400 feet.
Are you afraid of heights?
I hope not. Not in my career.
What about, and the rim of the Orlando Eye, I mean, is it like a kind of a smooth surface? Is it curved?
It is. It's actually a surface that is used for braking. In other words, for stopping that wheel from spinning. So it actually has a sandpaper. It's somewhat convenient if there is such a thing. It has almost a sandpaper texture to it that will hopefully help me gain traction, especially because it's looking as though this will be aired live on the Today Show. On the morning of the 29th, and because of that, of course, I live in Florida. I was born and raised there, and I know how humid it can be in the morning. So that sandpaper will definitely be very helpful for me to gain traction as I'm walking.
What about on your feet? Normally you would be wearing what, some kind of slippers almost?
Yeah, normally I wear a wire shoe that my mom makes for me. It's almost like an Indian moccasin that molds to my feet. It's got an elk skin bottom on it so that I can feel the wire through it, yet it protects my feet. And there's a good chance I'll be doing a rehearsal the day before, and I won't actually be walking, but I'll be climbing it to the point where I will be walking, and I'll kind of get an idea of what it's going to feel like and figure out which shoes I'll actually be wearing at that time.
And no safety harness?
No safety whatsoever.
Okay. Does that concern you at all?
It doesn't. You know, this has been my life. It's been my family's life for generations. I truly believe this was what I was born to do. And this is definitely my passion, is entertaining and hopefully through what I do, inspiring people to do greater things.
So I know it's a little different from what you've done in the past, but can you compare it to something like walking across the Niagara Falls in terms of difficulty or challenge?
Well, you know, definitely. This is very unique because of the actual structure. It's something that I'm not familiar with. Of course, as I mentioned recently, earlier in the conversation, I've walked on a wire my whole life. I haven't walked on observation wheels. So also the fact that this one is moving. I'm not in control anymore of my space, of my pace or my speed. Actually, the wheel is in control of me, and it's up to me whether I keep up with that wheel or not.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to yourself before you get onto a wire or before you get onto the room of the Orlando Eye? How do you psych yourself up for this?
You know, it's hard to describe because I've done it my whole life. I've entertained, I've performed, I've done events similar. It's about remaining calm, cool, and collected. If I let my thoughts take control, my thoughts of negativity or fear, it can become debilitating, and it's important that I keep those thoughts under control and that I'm confident in what I'm doing, or if I'm not, I shouldn't be taking the first step.
Mm-hmm. So how do you make sure that you kind of keep that calm?
You know, again, it's hard to describe because I've done it my whole life. I've been doing this. It's not something new to me. So, I think it's something that some people are made with and some people aren't. And I've been blessed with the ability to stay calm and collective before these events.
Getting back to the wheel itself, I'm assuming, you know, everything kind of moves a little bit, even if it's a solid structure. Do you have any sense of how much kind of play there is in that wheel?
You know, there's a little bit of play, but it's fairly, it's engineered fairly well. Of course, the general public is riding in this this day in and day out by the thousands and more. So because of that, it's been designed to be fairly stable. Otherwise, public, of course, would be getting nauseous and sick. So it's going to be fairly stable. There'll be a little bit of movement, but again, nothing that I'm not confident enough that I can't handle.
When you saw the Orlando Eye being built, was this something you kind of thought of before they approached you, or did they just kind
Absolutely
of come to you?
Absolutely, it was. It was something that I was in Orlando with my wife and kids, and we saw it, and I thought, wow, that's an amazing structure. I wonder if it's an opportunity to do a walk from. And we were reached out to soon after that, and lo and behold, here I am breaking another world record.
Mm-hmm. And they'll be watching on the day?
Absolutely. My wife, my kids, my mom, my father, my whole family is my major support team.
Nick Willander, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
From International Drive to Tanzania, PNC Vice President Greg Simmons decided to take some time out from the boardroom and made the trek up the 19,000-foot high Mount Kilimanjaro. He spoke with 90.7's Catherine Welch about the trip.
So let's start at the beginning. Did this all start with the thought, I think I'd like to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, or what exactly inspired you to do this?
I'm still kind of deciding that at this day, even what got me started on it. I know that a part of it was I wanted to lose a little weight. I wanted to get back in shape, and I had this motto of Kilimanjaro, not Kilimanjello, as corny as that might sound. But one thing I learned in business was you have to set big goals, and you need to break it down into smaller ones to achieve that. And this just seemed like such a great opportunity to go someplace new and exciting and, you know, out in a different world, and at the same point throughout the course of a year to climb another mountain, to run a race. It all made sense. It all fit together real nicely for me.
And so why this mountain?
Well, it's called Every Man's Everest. It's something that anyone can climb. They don't have to have technical experience, but they do need to be in good shape. And it's 19,341 feet. The biggest challenge is the elevation and, you know, obviously the acclimatization to go with the lack of oxygen. You don't really know how you're going to react to that, but the best way to do is to be as good a shape as possible. And obviously, even though I'm carrying a 30-pound pack, I don't want to carry any more than I absolutely have to.
Mount Kilimanjaro is billed as the world's tallest walkable mountain. So what kind of training was needed to prepare for it?
I did a number of things. As you probably know, Florida is somewhat flat. We have an elevation of about 300, I think, at our highest point. So for me, it involves stair climbing. I started at our PNC building in downtown Orlando, which is 12 stories high. And I went up and down twice the first week, and my legs felt like jello. By the time I was done, it was 20 times up and down with a pack, and also several times up and down the parking ramp as well. In addition to that, I did Orange Theory for cross training. That's an aerobic, you know, exercise. Did hot yoga, and then just did hiking with a backpack. So it was a lot of diversity.
And how long did you train to prepare for this trip?
Got the idea in about a year ago, and I had little steps along the way. I ran a 10-mile race last May. I climbed a couple mountains in Colorado in July. I did a 5K earlier in the spring last year as well. And then, you know, really started doing all the other, I would say, the stair steps in the fall, and then climbed Kilimanjaro in January. So it was almost a year.
So you're at Mount Kilimanjaro. It's a several-day journey up. Greg Simmons, what went through your head as you were face-to-face with the mountain?
I was very excited to start. You start off in a rainforest in shorts and in a T-shirt and with your friends, and you've got your hiking poles, and it's a wide trail like you're in a national park. And it's doesn't seem very challenging, but you know what's coming because you've done a lot of reading and educating, and I'm very excited about what's going to, you know, about doing this. So that's the biggest thing that I think, you know, when I first started, it was just excitement, and that's what you started off with.
What did you think it was going to be like as you were facing up that mountain?
I watched a lot of videos, and so I had a pretty good idea, and I guess there's always that fear of the unknown a little bit. How are you going to react? When I climbed Colorado, it was only, I think, around 13,000 feet, and it was out of breath, and it was really hard to take a step, but I hadn't acclimatized like I was going to do here. So I had a lot of faith in the program and the company that you know, we were all going on. So I guess I was a little nervous, but I was excited about all the different things I knew I was going to see and the friendships I was going to make along the way.
And now there are a number of ways to get to the top. Which path did you choose?
Great question. The Michimi route, which is about 6 days up, and it gives you time. It gives you time to acclimatize to the lack of oxygen.
That's one of the more difficult routes.
You know, I think I didn't think of it as difficult. Certainly there were some challenges along the way. To me, maybe going up quicker where you didn't have the chance might have been a bigger risk. So in this case, it's hard because you're there for a full week without, well, you have to treat your water to drink it. There's no bathroom. There's no shower. So it's a long week, you know, for sure.
And what did you encounter on the way out?
I saw plant life that I would never see before and I'll never see again because it's only on Kilimanjaro. You start, as I mentioned before, you start in a rainforest. Then you move into, and it literally is like a door closes and another door opens. You move into another temperate zone and you're in this foggy, moorish area that looks like you're on the in Scotland or on the moors or something there. And then you move into, all of a sudden, you move into another temperate zone where it feels like you're on Mars or the moon. I mean, it's literally nothing but volcanic rock and there's no life or anything around except for a few birds now and then that are hoping for handouts. And then lastly, you end up in an Arctic zone where you're literally standing next to a glacier. And, of course, wearing at that point no longer the shorts and short sleeves, but parkas and glacier glasses and gloves and hat and wind, and it's cold.
Wow. And once you're at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, Greg Simmons, was it what you expected?
It was. It was exhilarating. It was you literally are at the top of the world looking down. And I think what was surprising was to look down at other mountains that were around. Now, there aren't a whole lot, but there's a few in Africa. So they stood out on the horizon. And I had been at the base of those looking up, and now here I was looking down, and they looked like little bumps. That gave me some perspective about how high up we were. It was absolutely beautiful, and it all felt worth it. Of course, I had to turn around and go back down again, so that was a bit of a challenge.
And you can't really stay up too quickly, correct, because of the altitude?
The altitude is certainly, that's true. Yeah, you wouldn't want to stay up there for very long. We were up about a half an hour, took a bunch of pictures, congratulated ourselves heartily, and started the trek back down.
And did you go with friends? Or?
Well, there was a group of eight of us as a professional group that we'd hired, and two Canadians, the rest were Americans. And there were several other groups, international groups as well, that were climbing on the same time that we were.
So you've been on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. Has it changed you?
I like to think so. First, there's a cultural experience, and I think any time that we travel and meet other cultures, it expands our mind and our way of thinking, and that was one of the reasons that I was excited about this opportunity. I also think that any time you set a goal and you achieve it, it gives you confidence to face the next one, and it's exciting to face the next thing. And it certainly changed me. I lost about 25 pounds. I, you know, got in a little better shape, feel more prepared for the next thing. And so that's just the beginning, I think. We'll see how this changes, you know, last over time and what other things come to the surface.
And I think you touched on it a little bit. Was there anything you learned, not just from this climb, but the entire process that's influenced how you do things, both personally and professionally?
I like to think that I always appreciated the team that I had around me at work, but even more so now. This trip up the mountain was not one person. This was porters, the guide, the mentor, all of the organization and the logistics that it took to move one person, that's me, up this mountain. It's the same thing at work. You know, you cannot discount the value of the team, the encouragement, the leadership that we have, and the backroom support to, you know, just to win one customer, which is obviously, you know, one of our biggest goals.
So with Mount Kilimanjaro under your belt, what's next?
Well, I'm going to recover a little financially. And I think, so this year, I think I'm going to try to do a triathlon. So take my biking and my running experience and expand that just a little bit and do some swimming, which I think would be great. I really want to do that this year. And then I want to do Machu Picchu. I'm kind of hoping maybe the following year that would be on my horizon.
All right. Greg Simmons, Vice President of Small Business Administration for the Eastern Territory at PNC Bank. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. The conversation about modern day adventurers continues after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Pat Rushen is the author of the novella The Call, subtitled A Virtual Parable. It's the story of a man who lives in a windowless apartment and spends his time waiting for a phone call that he thinks will bring his life meaning. Other characters in the dystopian book include a young computer hacker and an online dominatrix. Rushen adapted the book for a screenplay, which was then made into a movie, The Zero Theorem, directed by Terry Gilliam and starring Christoph Waltz. Rushen is an associate professor of English. He teaches creative writing at the University of Central Florida. Welcome to Intersection.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Tell me about the genesis of the story, because the movie was produced and released in 2013, correct?
Right. The first draft of that novella I wrote in 1999, believe it or not. And I wrote it in 3 weeks. It just kind of poured out of me. And I showed it around to some people and everything. And I was revising it. Trying to get it in shape to publish it, and a friend of mine said, he said, this would make a great movie. you should write a screenplay. And I said, well, I've never written a screenplay before. He goes, oh, it's easy. Just write it. So I did. I wrote it. I'm not going to say it was easy, you know, but I made a lot of mistakes along the way. But I wrote it and I rewrote it and so forth. And at a certain point, it got picked up by the Zanuck Company in Hollywood, and they put their weight behind it and wanted to produce it. And then, you know, there were sort of ups and downs, you know. Originally, Ewan McGregor was going to play the lead, and then he dropped out, and somebody else was going to do this, and they dropped out. And then we sent it to Terry Gilliam when he was working on The Brothers Grimm. Mm-hmm. With Matt Damon and Heath Ledger. And he didn't even read it at that time. So a number of people passed on it. I rewrote it a few more times for a few different directors. Nothing ever came of it. And then suddenly, Richard Zanuck got in touch with Terry Gilliam. And Gilliam was very interested in working with Zanuck at this point, because he'd seen what Zanuck had done for Tim Burton, working with him. And he wanted a producer like that. So he showed him The Zero Theorem, and he liked it. He thought it was a smart script and funny and odd enough for his for his sensibilities. So he decided to do it. And the only problem was the first time around, he got Billy Bob Thornton to play the lead, which was fine with me. I mean, I thought he'd do pretty good. And they were going to shoot in London, which is where Gilliam lives, and Billy Bob Thornton put the nicks on that because he has a phobia of antiques, and there's a lot of antiques in London as far as he's concerned. I mean, I couldn't believe when Richard Zanuck told me that. I said, they got drugs for that, Dick. He says, yeah, that's what I told him. But anyway, so that fell through. It's amazing the movies ever get made at all, really, because, you know, just anything can make them fall through. So the next time out, we were going to shoot in Vancouver, because there's not any old things there, apparently. But that's when Terry Gilliam was working on The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus with Heath Ledger, and Heath Ledger died in the middle of shooting. And so that put them way behind schedule and so forth. And once again, The Zero Theorem got pushed onto a back burner and didn't get made. And that was at a point where I thought this thing's just never going to get made. But the main producer, Dean Zanuck, who's Richard Zanuck's son, who was spearheading the thing, said, it's going to get made. Don't worry, Pat. Sooner or later, it's going to get made. And sure enough, sooner or later, it did. When, you know, a couple summers later, I get a call from Dean Zanuck. He says everything's Voltage Pictures is involved. They've got the financing. Terry's on board. Everybody's ready to go. Christoph Waltz wants to play the lead. He says, pack your bags, you're going to Romania. That's how it came about.
So how involved were you during the shooting? Like, were you on set as a consultant, or how does that actually work?
I was the writer, and they say, you know, keep the writer off the set. That's kind of the big joke, but although they treated me great. I was an extra. Terry Gilliam, as soon as I got on the set, he says, take this man to wardrobe, and I was an extra in a scene in a park. I walked back and forth in the background. Dressed in a really hot plastic colorful suit. The costumes were very colorful, and they were made out of shower curtains. It was like really done on the cheap. So I sweated. So I did that for 2 days. But otherwise, I was also doing some writing on the set. And in fact, there is a clip in the movie that shows me and my wife sitting on a park bench. She's reading a newspaper, and I'm writing on a legal pad. Well, what I'm writing on that legal pad are lines that Terry asked me to change and do. So he's got the writer in the background writing.
In terms of the movie, it's presented as the third in a trilogy that begins with Brazil and then 12 Monkeys, and this is the third. Is that the way you saw the screenplay, though?
No. I mean, I didn't even... I mean, you know, I'm a major fan of Terry Gilliam, always have been, and probably even, you know, psychologically, subconsciously, I may have been somehow influenced. He swears that I wrote this for him and only for him, but I didn't. If, you know, any other director that wanted to pick it up, I was ready to sell it.
There are some themes, though. I mean, the thing that strikes me about it is there's this aura of menace over it, and that's kind of consistent with what you have in, say, Brazil.
For sure. And 12 Monkeys as well. Mm-hmm. But there's so many other dystopian stories as well. I mean,
sure.
It's not just just those two. So, you know, if you pick and choose. And again, I mean, I'm a big fan. And, of course, I had seen Brazil and 12 Monkeys and loved them both. Mm-hmm. And I'm thrilled that he wants to call the Zero Theorem the third in the trilogy. I mean, that's great.
Is science fiction what you're most comfortable writing?
I started off writing science fiction and wrote it for years and didn't publish it. But actually, the first story I ever got accepted for publication was science fiction. And it didn't get published because the magazine folded before they published it. I got a kill fee. But I'd always read science fiction, and I wrote science fiction. I loved it. When I was in graduate school and working on my graduate thesis, which was a collection of fiction, my thesis advisor at that time wouldn't let me write science fiction. He said, nope. He says, you got to write something real, Pat. So I turned to writing something real and found out, you know, I liked realism. I mean, I do like it. But yeah, I mean, I can get back into science fiction and be very happy there. But I'm not what I'd call, you know, I'm not hardcore science fiction. For one thing, I don't know that much about science.
It's far from paradise, what you're describing in this book.
Right.
Why do you find yourself drawn to that kind of world?
Well, because I think that's reality. I mean, I think we live in dystopia, you know. I mean, you know, you don't have to go into the future to see dystopia. You know, I think it's here all around us. Things just don't work quite the way, you know, we envisioned they would.
Mm-hmm.
You know? All the best ideas we have somehow mess up. So I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't want to be a pessimist about it, because actually I am an optimist, and I look for a happy ending in anything I write. Terry Gilliam cut out my happy ending in the Zero Theorem, you know, because he's not a happy ending kind of guy.
Talk to me about the state of writing and fiction here in Central Florida. Do you get the sense there are a lot of talented young writers coming up?
I see a lot of young competition. I mean, I feel like an old fart that's, you know, going to get pushed out of the game here pretty soon, especially out at the university. I mean, we have some really fine writers. A number of my students who are publishing and publishing well, and that's good to see too. But it's a good Orlando's a good. I don't know. There's a lot of camaraderie.
Is that unusual?
It can be, yeah. I mean, I've lived in places where, you know, writers just didn't want to hang out together at all because they kind of looked at each other as the competition.
Pat Rushen is the author of The Call, which was made into the movie The Zero Theorem. He teaches creative writing at the University of Central Florida. Thank you very much for joining me.
Great. Thanks for having me.
The conversation continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.